Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. We're heading into holiday season. I hope you're doing well.
And on the political right, Senator Dan McKay.
Hey, I have a Christmas tree up, so I feel you.
This is a special version of Both Sides of the Aisle. We're going to do a little bit of a postmortem on the election, but we're also going to do a look forward in the 2025 general legislative session of the Utah legislature. So it should be a good conversation.
Yes.
Shireen, I'll start with you. I've been doing a lot of reading and kind of thinking in a postmortem kind of way about the big election. David Brooks says we've entered a new political era.
Yeah.
He characterizes it as one where things are being redistributed. Used to be that Democrats were the working class vote. Now that's gone to the Republicans.
Yeah.
Used to be that you could define someone's votes by their race, ethnicity. Can't do that anymore. You can more define it by their education levels, interestingly.
Yeah.
And anyway, do you agree with that? It's a whole new political era.
So the other side of that, non-college educated working class voters used to be with Democrats. Mm-hmm. And college educated white voters used to be pretty much with Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a flipping there. I would say the bigger, I'm a little reluctant to make sweeping generalizations mm-hmm. based on the results of this election.
Okay.
And I think the primary reason for that is we know a lot of people sat this election out. This mm-hmm. was not a super high mm-hmm. engagement election. And we also know that in the end, Trump, I think, came out with 50%, but 49.9% of the vote. Harris had 48.3, I think, of mm-hmm. the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
So making these kind of, we're definitely seeing trends in movement, but I think this was going to be a pivotal election anyway.
Okay.
But I think we sort of set it up in a way that led to disaster for Democrats and potentially disaster for this country. But
okay.
We can talk about that more in a minute.
Dan, do you agree that it's a new political era? Do you think David Brooks also says it's a period of whitewater? You know, that
what does he mean by whitewater?
I think what he's meaning is that a lot of things were said that Donald Trump was a fascist, but really he's a sower of chaos. This is what he's trying to say. And so disorder shakes everything loose,
so
challenging
now,
institutions, you know, making the kind of cabinet picks that he's made, you know, just essentially shock and awe a little bit.
Well, and the fact that the American people know that that's where things that's who Donald Trump is going to be as a president,
yeah.
and that
they certainly
selected
knew that.
Him. And it wasn't like, you know, I'll say this. I did not anticipate that we would have a Republican that wins the popular vote. I just felt like that those days were behind us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason, you know, Electoral College is really the only way the Republicans were ever going to win. I mean, this started to get into my mind. But for some reason, right, you know, Trump won the popular vote. And that is a big statement as to, you know, those of us who get close to the system, so to speak, like, you know, I always think like your first term, it's you against the system. The second term, you know, it's the system and you trying to figure out your relationship. And then the third term, you know, you're really an advocate for the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
That's what I've seen with people. And so it's interesting, like seeing that the American people are just tired of the system and they want some shaking up. They want to see guys like Elon Musk or, you know, for whatever purpose it is, come in and disrupt some things because they really do believe that there is bloat or they feel like things are just not generally trending in the right direction and some disruption is needed, even if it might be disrupting their own way of life.
Yeah. I do think it's important to understand this popular vote. This has been a point of like trying to understand it for me. Trump's popular vote margin over Harris was actually smaller than Clinton's over him in 2016. So when we're talking about how big this popular vote win was, mm-hmm. it was still small. And I actually have some insight into this.
I didn't think he'd win at
about
all.
Why? Yeah.
No, I didn't think the popular vote was possible. It's not like
totally agree.
Thin. It's like whatever.
So I just want to add one piece of this. One thing that I think is interesting that the Harris campaign is reporting out is in the 100 days that they had basically of this campaign, they did not campaign really in states outside of seven states. So when you think
that
about
the popular.
When you don't convince people, remind people, then you're seeing that huge depression.
Interesting.
There were some really interesting numbers.
Shereen, Brett Stevens is someone I follow. His work, a great writer and thinker. But he talked about several tactical mistakes that the Vice President Harris made. I'll list just a couple of them. Picking a progressive running mate who couldn't deliver a must-win state. Inability to separate herself from Biden. Over-reliance on celebrity. Anointed without competition.
Yeah.
Failure to make Biden's mental to take Biden's mental decline seriously.
Yeah.
Quick reaction to those, because those seem pretty on point to me.
They seem on point to me. I think I would say the biggest one for me is that we didn't have. I feel like I expressed this on the show a long time ago, but I feel like Biden sort of winked at that he would be a one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't do that.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
we did not have an open and honest conversation about where the Democrat, like where yeah. Democrats are yeah. in this country. Mm-hmm. And I do not think that Harris would have been our candidate. And I believe that mm-hmm. she did an impossibly good job under terrible circumstances. I really do. I think she executed.
She was fabulous
at
in so many ways.
An incredibly high level yeah. for the moment. I think she rose to it. But because we didn't have that conversation, I think it was doomed.
Yeah.
Well, and that hurts. That hurts. You think about it when you talk about a presidential election is those seven states. But the primaries are the broader states, right?
Exactly.
And so the inability of those primaries kind of leads into the fact that people didn't turn out to,
yeah,
to
very
your popular
interesting.
Vote question.
Okay, Dan, I can't wait to hear your take on this. Just because I think you have a political mind. You've been on the ballot a lot. This is kind of core to who you are. But many have said that Democrats need an intellectual autopsy. Peggy Noonan wrote that this was not a person election, but a path election. She's saying that people weren't voting for the person.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly they despise Donald Trump. At least a lot of Americans do. Mm-hmm. She does. She says that.
Mm-hmm.
But a path election, and it's basically this idea that America finds modern liberalism distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
And this is moral objections to gender transitions, counterproductive DEI things, mm-hmm. Too much social engineering, teachers' unions, higher taxes. It just doesn't, it's not what America wants.
Yeah.
And so when I say an intellectual autopsy, it's like, what do Democrats stand for right now? And we'll let Shereen answer that, but I want to hear what
Democrats you think. If the Democrats came to my door and asked me for advice for 2028, I would tell them that they should get rid of the word should from the vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Social engineering kind of stuff.
Yes. And, uh-huh. and when I say should, what I mean by that is, you should feel this way. You should think this way. You should do this. You should, right? The word should is prescribing a value base onto American people that I think, to Peggy Noonan's point on the path, I think they just got sick of being told that they shouldn't feel good about who they are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad enough to beat yourself up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then to be in politics or paying attention to news radio or whatever it is, and or social media, whatever the medium, and somebody's telling you that you are too privileged, but you're fighting paycheck to paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's telling you that we're giving this job to somebody else because of their race, ethnicity, instead of you, you know, when they're looking for a job as well and competing in that job market. I think all of those indicators, there was enough of the rebuff where they said, I'm tired of being told what I should do. What I really want to do is I really want to support my family, and I'm mm-hmm. going to focus on a candidate or a party or whatever that's going to help me support
Give me
my family.
The best
family.
Path. Mm-hmm. Shereen, they say that all defeat carries a gift, and now the Democrats get to figure out what they're doing wrong.
Ah,
tell me what you're thinking. If there's a, you know, if there's a coming home here, what is it? What does it look like?
So I would say for a number of years, it feels to me, and it's getting harder and harder for me to feel at home in the Democratic Party. I don't see a party that is explicitly anti-war. I don't see a party that is
working class.
Tells the story mm-hmm. of being anti-poverty, even mm-hmm. though I think they are anti-poverty, more so in policy. But they're just like so many missed opportunities in the Biden administration. I think about the CHIPS Act. 800,000 manufacturing jobs, 70% of those that could be eligible for non-college educated men, generally. Mm-hmm. We didn't tell that story at all. We didn't tell that story at all, right? And so I think that there's this notion that we get sucked up into, we get distracted by the distractions that I often think are advanced by Republican conservatives, or specifically around trying to enforce a moral framework, a moral suitability test about what we should or should not be able to do with our bodies or our healthcare, like all these kinds of things. Democrats get, I think, often too distracted by that and do not focus on telling the story about the actual bread and butter issues where we're fighting for people.
Yeah.
I think about things like increases to food stamps, to SNAP. I think about investments in technical colleges and desire to bring down the cost of childcare. Those were all things. We think about the insulin. I feel like that's the one thing that the Biden administration or Harris actually talked about. But when we think about lowering costs for seniors and seeing that the senior vote actually stayed with Harris. I think if we make arguments about things that impact people's lives, bread and butter issues, kitchen table issues, we have a strong argument to make. But I also think that we have lost a moral compass that I believe our party should have. And that ranges on wars that we're engaged in. It's, you know, to, again, I think core issues around housing and poverty.
Yeah, really interesting. David French, New York Times columnist, in his advice to Democrats, he said, shorten the darkness. So grieve the loss, but only for a short time. There's work to be done.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, the border crisis is real. Mm-hmm. Inflation is a problem.
Yeah.
Too much insulting of voters.
Telling people that they that their problems weren't really problems was not successful for the Democratic ticket this time.
A lot of times they've called this cultural imperialism in an interesting way. What would you guys predict? We got just a 1 minute left in this part of the segment. What would you predict for the Democrats, Shereen?
I would guess that we're going to go to some of our leaders that have had the greatest success in difficult places. And I, you know, I'm a huge fan of Big Gretchen Whitmer out of Michigan, to see folks who are winning in working class states, like in places where we still think about issues like manufacturing, where we think about a simple message, which was her message was when she ran and won twice, was fix the damn roads, right? Like going back to issues that are kind of core everyday issues and finding a way to really highlight the chaos and disruption that is here with the Republican Party.
Yeah. Dan, quick comments on either the remake of the D's or where the R's are headed.
Well, I worry that the R's are going to take this as, hey, we've got it all figured out because look, we just won. And not learn their own lessons from 2024.
Like if they fail to reform immigration in the first year of this
exactly.
new Congress.
And you think about, I've thought that was interesting. Trump, if he had gotten reelected, he would have 4 years without a unified House and Senate, right? Now he gets reelected 4 years later, and he at least has 2 years of a unified House and Senate, supposedly of his same party.
Yeah.
And if you can't solve immigration, despite being that your issue over and over again, and can't come up with a reasonable way to get this thing done, they're going to learn another lesson in 2028.
My advice to both parties is stand for something.
Yeah.
Stand for something you believe in that will make America better. And if we do that, we'll be okay. All right. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the 2025 legislative session. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shereen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We're going to preview the 2025 legislative session up on Capitol Hill. We have a senator in the studio with us, and Shereen has all her great experience as a county council member and a candidate for Congress. And I'm just one of these behind-the-scenes policy people. But I've watched a lot of legislative sessions at this point. And Dan, just to set this up, our legislature is a part-time legislature. They're in session for 45 days a year in their general session. It will start Tuesday after the Martin Luther King holiday.
Yeah.
I think that's like the 21st this year, 22nd, 22nd
like
this year. Yeah, go ahead.
Could you put in context, is this, so some states have full-time legislators, right? Where do we fall in, I think where I'm from, I think they meet every 2 years.
Yeah, some are every other year.
Yeah. So what do you, the thing
California's
that I think,
is full-time,
full-time,
you know, yeah.
I you know, certainly we have interim sessions, and a couple of years ago, the legislature gave themselves the right to call themselves back into session. But what would you say in terms of like time And something that I always think is interesting is I recommend to people that they should reach out to their legislators to build those relationships when they live in their districts in like July, August, September. Yeah. At this point, it's really hard to get on your legislator's radar. But give us just kind of a little overview of like the time that this takes and kind of when it's best for people to get in touch with you if they want to talk to you about an issue.
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting to talk about an issue. If someone's expecting a bill to pass, absolutely. You got to be in touch in May or June, July, right?
Yeah.
But if there's an issue that is percolating at the legislature and it affects your business, it affects your life, it affects, you know, it's a good time. It's always a good time to reach out on those issues is what I was going to say. It's like we've got, you know, legislative interns during the session who are handling, you know, making sure we get communications and seeing things from constituents. And I think those things are super important. With me, you know, I get text messages all the time from people. And I'm always telling people, text me because it's super easy. I'm sitting in a lot of meetings, but I can text. And I love that type of free form of communication. I hear from a lot of people on, you know, social media, you know, things every once in a while. I love those conversations as well. I just, you know, the session gets so frenetic and there are so many things going on. It is like ping pongs dropped off of a tower and you're trying to trace them all,
yeah.
You know. It's not easy. And I just say, if your legislator isn't getting back to you, give them a little time. I promise they'll be around at least around election time.
Yeah. But I would suggest like in that notion, I do think texting is often good and effective, but to get that phone number is usually a couple of other conversations, right? Like to get to that phase. So I would just say it is, I think that's correct. Getting
not mine, 801-810-4110. Shoot me a text.
But for a lot of people, it can be harder to get that kind of access. But I think it's actually, I applaud you giving your number. And I will say that I think it is incumbent upon those who want to represent us to grant that kind of access.
Yeah.
So that we can have our voices heard.
So, Dan, we're starting to hear with we had an election. We had constitutional amendments on the ballot. Two of them judges said, nope, you didn't follow the public process well enough. The Supreme Court agreed with them, really bothered the legislature to see the courts insert themselves in this way. And so you're starting to hear things that the judiciary is going to be in the crosshairs this session, taking away judges, making it partisan, playing with their retirement, their pensions.
Yeah.
What are they talking about?
I mean, some of those things are nipping around the heels of and just highlight a bad relationship, right?
Make them be elected rather than appointed, these kinds
of
things.
I'd say that it's, you know, The fight between the courts and the legislature and the governor and the legislature and the governor and the courts, I love it. Mm-hmm. To me, that's indicative of a system that is working, right? Mm-hmm. It there should be tension. There should be, you know, there should be some pushback because the legislature is moored to the people, right? And they're, you know, people are voting for them constantly. The judges are completely, bless their hearts, they're an aristocracy in some respects because they have retention elections that are 99% effective, and they aren't really moored to people, which can be a benefit, but not being moored to the people can also create problems.
How do you become a judge?
You apply. So they announce, so the Bar Association and the courts send out an email to all lawyers because you
vacancy.
Have to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they let us know that there's a vacancy, and they accept applications. And we used to get, you know, 40 to 50 applications. Now we're down to 10 to 15 applications.
And who approves them?
So they go to the Judicial Nominating Commission and they review. No, this is a third party independent commission that reviews their qualifications, reviews their criminal records, bunch of confidential information, puts them really through a ringer, right? And then there's a bunch of surveys that go out to people that have worked with the lawyer and trying to get feedback and those things. And then they pick among those candidates, those that they feel like are most qualified, right? That screening process is pretty unique to Utah because it is not, it's not something that exists in other states in the same fashion. In other states,
they put forward three names to the governor.
Yeah, and they put three names forward to the governor, and the governor picks one of those three.
And that has to be confirmed.
It has to be confirmed by
the Senate.
Yeah.
So
this is rigorous.
That's rigorous.
It's independent.
It's not like you just roll it. Yeah.
But for the most part, it's a one-time rigorous thing, right? You could do, say, whatever to get through that process potentially, and then once you get on the other side of it, you know, and we see this actually with federal judges, and this happens on both sides of the party where everybody says, well, you told us you were this person and
Shereen,
it wasn't.
As someone who's worked in public policy for over three decades now, I don't have a lot of interaction with judges, but I will tell you when I do, I'm super impressed.
Yeah.
Super impressed. Either I'll read, you know, their
opinions
or just in my interaction with them. But I just am a huge fan of the judges I know. And I'm sure it's because of that vetting process.
Yeah. It does breed for good temperament. That process is good for temperament. It is good for, you know, intelligence. It's good for a lot of those things.
It sounds like it might not be good for political desires, though.
But, you know, the strength of the system is really more to the people. Yeah. I mean, the constitutions of both the federal and the United States, it is we the people. And that's it's trying to find
so
that balance.
Shereen, I'll make a prediction that the House goes hog wild on putting all sorts of pressure on the judiciary and the Senate holds strong. And there's some nibbling around the edges, but largely it'll be held intact. That's my prediction.
That's probably fair.
OK, cool. Let's go to another one. What about higher ed? You know, there's so much pressure on higher ed right now, in part because of liberalism and the so-called woke agenda that people seem to think lives in college campuses. But what do you
seem to think, Natalie? Seem? I like this. Go ahead.
Well, what are we expecting? I mean, the speaker has basically said, get ready for 10% cuts. Mm-hmm. I find that interesting at a time when higher education couldn't be more important to the future of our state. And I just mean that we're in the information age. We're in the AI age. We're in the age of modern medicine. The highly skilled and trained scientists, engineers, you know, the people that we need. I mean, mental health professionals. I mean, I think states will benefit from transforming higher ed, but not taking it away as a priority.
I show, unfortunately, you guys, you know, can't see this, but this.
The listeners, Dan's showing us his laptop with some data.
This is the partisan mix as a percentage of the faculty and staff at higher ed, right?
And who did? I mean, who did this?
It's blue and red, right?
And Langbert was. It was a study that was done, and it wasn't. It wasn't a partisan study. It was a partisan study as to who they were, but this was out of a university that did the study.
I just have to say that the list does not include business, Dan. We are a college at the University of Utah. It has psychology and history and mathematics and physics.
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't disagree with you. I didn't make the chart.
Questions about the data.
I didn't make the chart. I'm just
but
saying.
But you just believe it.
What I don't have is the other side of this chart that showed what a similar study was done in the 1980s. And it was closer to 50-50 across all disciplines.
Oh, it's totally fair.
And so
it's totally fair.
It's that we're seeing a conservative brain drain from universities where they literally don't want to be part of the system.
Yeah. But
and so
what
that's
you're
all
saying though is that the frustration is ideological.
Yes.
And I think universities they're supposed to be this broad based thinking and think about and be aware of and focusing on things. What it has done, though, is it has gone further and further and more insular and less about college thinking and has become more and more about progressive policy.
I have a lot of confidence in our students and our families and our households and whatnot to find the ideological path that works for you in your life and that being exposed to a broad liberal arts education, picking what you want to specialize in, that you have the power to pick the ideology that works for you.
Yeah.
But
I remember in my political science class, I wrote about, you know, the basis for the Electoral College and its balance and, you know, why it balances the nation. Mm-hmm. My Democrat professor at the time gave me a D on the paper and I was frustrated about it. I appealed the grade and I got an A.
Nice.
But it just like... It's those kinds of things where
his ideology affected his grade.
It did. And he even later admitted that.
Yeah.
Right. And,
So I'll just add that I think one of the things that I'm concerned about is on one hand, we're talking about additional cuts. There have been numerous cuts over the years to higher education in this state and across the country. Right. And then on the other side, we hear legislators in particular complaining about the high cost of higher education, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're, you know, we just had a conversation about tariffs, but when we're thinking about a 10% cut, certainly there are opportunities to tighten belts at universities, I understand that. But ultimately, those costs get passed on to students. And then we have this kind of cycle of the competing, complaining.
Yeah. Hey, we're down to a minute, 15 seconds in this program. Quick take on elections, Dan. What are they trying to do with the lieutenant governor as the chief election officer?
Well, in our Constitution, that's one of the duties of the lieutenant governor. And I'd say you've got this consternation where some Republicans felt like they, you know, that the lieutenant governor is conflicted and shouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the issues where I think you've got a lot of people in the House saying this needs to be done. And then some of us in the Senate who are saying, really?
Yeah.
I just thought it was amazing that after this Trump win, we basically heard nothing about election fraud. So sounds like the problems have resolved themselves.
It was a very good exercise in solving all
this. I'll go out on a limb. I'm a huge Deidre Henderson fan. She's done a terrific job as lieutenant governor, but I have long wanted an independent election office because I worked in the governor's office and I felt like a lieutenant governor had other things to be focused on.
So interesting.
We'll see how it goes. Hey, we have got to make that a wrap. What a great program. Fun to be with my friends, Dan McCain, Shereen Gurbani. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and happy holidays.